would have been really crazy if we actually did. Like, one had paper, one had scissors, one had rope. Oh, yes. My name is Thomas Van Cannon, age 27. Today's date is October 4th, 2007. We are currently at the 51st Annual Meeting of the Human Factors and Ergonomics Society in Baltimore. And I'm new to most of the people here, so that's me.
My name is John Hull. I'm 28. Today's date is October 4th, 2007. We're here at the Baltimore, Maryland 51st Anniversary HFES Conference. And I know Deanne through school and friendship, and I don't know this gentleman sitting next to me. So I've been introduced to him right now.
Excellent. And my name is Deanne Harp. I'm a moldy old 32 now, and today's date
wow.
for me is also, I know, today's date for me is also October 4th, 2007, and we are in Baltimore attending the HFES conference. I call this the nerd conference, but in an affectionate way. And I am the connection between these two folks. I met Thomas over breakfast this morning because I'm a friendly networking kind of gal, and John...
She's trying to meet every person in the conference.
It, as you say, it's my superpower. And John I know through numerous projects at school and thesis cafes and who knows what else, but definitely school is our main connection. So to start out, I'd like to ask you guys, where are you in your career in human factors ergonomics?
Well, as far as the career goes, I guess I'm currently in a PhD program, and I'm about at the halfway point. I've just finished taking my comprehensive exams, and so academically speaking, I'm there. As far as work goes and direction goes, I've actually been interested in human-robot interaction for a while, and mostly focusing on work with unmanned ground vehicles and things of that nature, autonomy and how that's going to factor into stuff. And teams and team relationships and all that. So I know my direction. I know where I'm going pretty much. It's just a matter of where I'm doing it and how long it takes me to get through my program. So maybe about 2-3 more years left. What about you guys?
Well, for me, it's kind of an interesting question because it's something I've been doing my whole life since I was very young. I just didn't know what it was called, what I was doing. And but now I'm at the point where I'm starting to do it professionally. And so it's an interesting transition, taking something you love and then actually starting to make money at it.
So. And how much longer before you finish with school?
That is a good question. It depends on how long my thesis takes, thesis/project. Yes. and so hopefully, if all goes according to plan, it should be about one more year. And but then, as we know, life seldom goes according to plan.
Right on. And right now, I myself have been working 9, 10, depends on when you start counting, years in the business, largely in software and internet applications, primarily when the internet came out, that became the sole focus. And I also am getting my master's degree at San Jose State U, and under the fabulous guidance of Tony Andre. And right now, my projected finish date is May 2008. Let it be so.
Now, let me ask you, Dan, when was the first inkling you had that this thing called human factors was something that you wanted to do?
Well, that really is an interesting story. I had been in the profession a while, actually. This is a totally accidental career for me, totally accidental. Initially, when I was a kid, I wanted to be a cartoonist. And I'm a person of limited artistic ability, but I can do a picture and something funny. So I would have been Gary Larson type.
I like that.
And then I was like, hey, Dad, I want to be an architect. That was the second career. And Dad was like, because he had been one himself, or civil engineer, and he said, you'll never make any money at it. Crushed. I went back to the drawing board, and then teacher came up. So they don't make many money either, but that does fit my persona. So after much wandering in the desert and a couple academic degrees, I came to California and I had to afford myself. I knew HTML, I got picked up. And so I progressed rapidly through the biz because I was able to discern patterns and be able to analyze and talk to people and translate, make peace between warring factions, all in the name of helping improve the interface for users. But it wasn't until I worked on a medical application that it really took hold, and I said, I really can make a difference. And this actually, I started to see the correlation between cartoonist, teacher, and architect, because I draw, I design for longer term, but I also translate and communicate to folks, like I said. It's really been a nice combination, an accidental career. So about 5 years into it, it really took hold at that point.
How did you get into it?
Well, that's a very long story, because as I as I said, I've been doing it my whole life. So when I was about five, I grew up in the middle of nowhere. So we didn't have TV because we were too far out for cable. We didn't have telephones. We had dirt roads. And so there was nothing much to do. And my dad brought home a Macintosh computer in 1984 when I was five. And this was something to do. And so I went through all the programs. There was a paint program. There was a writing program. But I was kind of too young to really know how to write. And so I went through all the programs. I tried them all out, and I used them. And there was this one program on there called BASIC. And I was like, I didn't know what it did. And so I asked my dad, what's this? How do I use this? And he's like, don't do that. That's dangerous. And so I said, that's what I want to use. So I set about begging and said, I want to use that. Okay, so he's like, okay, but I have to be there when you do it. So he slowly kind of got some books, and he showed me, okay, here's how you do, you know, print out a thing. And so I made little programs that said, all right, you know, type in the type of animal, and I'd type in cat, and it would list my cats. And that's how I started programming. I made, like, a Yahtzee game. It would do little random things.
And this is at the tender age of 5.5
This is about, like, 5, 6. Oh. And then when I was about 11... my dad brought home a new computer, which had something called HyperCard on it, which allowed like this graphics thing. So it was a whole new thing, because all of the things I had seen before were just text, and I would actually put in wait times because it was so quick to, you know, go get the animal, because I had five. That's not how computers behave. They took a while, so I put in wait and it'd say processing, because that is how computers were supposed to behave. So when I found this HyperCard thing, I fell in love, because it was this whole new world of this graphical interface where I could make a button and you could click on it, and I had not known how to do that before. Anyway, so I got into the whole programming thing, and I learned more and more programming languages, and I would design programs, and I'd enjoy that. I'd get all excited, and I'd do it, and then I'd have to make them. And moving beyond HyperCard, it was hard to make them because it's all this boring stuff. And but I enjoyed making the interfaces. So I'd get all the programming books on interfaces and stuff. And so one day I was in there looking for books on, you know, how to make a good interface for my program. And I found one that was called Interface Design, and it was by Peter Bickford. And as I was reading through it, he was talking about, well, this is my job. I just design the interfaces. And like, I was like, oh my God, there's a job where you just do the fun part. And from that moment, I knew that, okay, that's what I want to do. I don't want to do the programming aspect of it. I want to, even though I still know all that stuff, I want to do just the fun part. And that's how I got into it.
Gotcha. And what of you? How did you get in, and why did you choose robotics? I mean, how did that transition occur?
That was a very, very interesting progression. I guess I've always been a geek. Big surprise. So back when I was in school, I'd always do the summer math and engineering programs. And, oh, you're good at math, you're good at science, so you should be an engineer. And that's sort of the direction that I took my first year in college, or my first couple of years in there. But at the same time, I was also really interested in psychology. And eventually, engineering, okay, this is boring. I mean, not that I couldn't do it or anything, it just didn't interest me. I mean, in high school, I had gone up to linear algebra, number theory, and a lot of stuff like that, and I could do the math, I just didn't like it. So eventually, I switched over to psychology, and not long after that happened, I heard about human factors, and in one of my perception classes, someone was saying, the instructor was saying that, there was this thing about driving and how the center light, or the original design of a car didn't have that center light on the back of it. And if you add that center light, it actually it increased reaction time and increased driving safety. And I was like, holy fucking shit. Yeah, I can use psychology and engineering at the same time, and this is just my calling. So and I've always been like a jack of all trades. I'd play around in a number of different areas, and it was just a perfect way to pull them all together. It was like, this is me. So while the driving part was interesting and it showed me where the field was, that wasn't where my main interest was. I was always interested in computers and stuff like that. And it was like, there's this area in here called human-computer interaction. So when I was over at USF in Tampa, I was hunting down people that did stuff like that. And, of course, it was difficult to find people because they weren't a real human factors, a strong human factors-oriented school. Through networking and stuff, I ended up working with Robin Murphy, who worked with the Center for Robot-Assisted Search and Rescue. And that's how I first got into it. And from there, I developed my love of human-robot interaction, focusing on the unmanned ground vehicle aspect, which is sort of how I got into work over at University of Central Florida. Doing work with the Army Research Lab, and that's where I am now. And I love that area. And from that, I've branched out into a number of areas from human-robot interaction that kind of get at the main issues. So I'm also a team psychologist. I also do the perception and the cognitive side, decision-making, and fun. So
and fun.
And fun. And it is fun. And I enjoy it. I really enjoy it. And it's good times.
How do you find that the detours on your road to human factors there help you now? Like, do you find that even if you had gone straight to human factors, maybe there's something you wouldn't have gotten that you got through all these zigzags?
I'd probably say I am unique because I do believe that just about every experience that you have in life helps you in some respect. I mean, in some manner or another, you can pull things from it. And it's not so much something that might make you a better researcher, per se, but it'll also help you in your career at the same time. Because I guess I always love travel. So through traveling and going through all of the different countries around the U.S., I've learned about different types of people, and I always believe in learning about different types of people. The more you understand about people and working with them, the better you can be at bringing that into your work, your job, and that does factor into, say, lab performance. As far as, like, my research life goes, I am this weird mutt of many different things. So I have industrial organizational psychology behind me, and through that approach, that's how I'm focused on teams, and I understand those relationships. But at the same time, I'm also an applied experimental program, so that's where I get a lot of the cognition and other things coming into it, and spatial ability. But also at the same time, I do value engineering perspectives. And while the psychologists and the engineers have very different approaches to things, they both bring very different things to the table, and they don't always mesh well together. Each person brings something valuable to the table, and I believe in also learning about the engineering side of things. So I'm trying at the same time. I'm also developing. I'm getting a master's in industrial engineering. through their programs. So at the end, I will have a master's in engineering and a PhD in psychology through human factors. So that's kind of that. But yeah, I do believe that that diversity really helps. But yeah, how about you guys? Have you guys really played around in different things other than that? What do you feel?
Well, I have a degree in mathematics at one point, and that
you look like a mathematician.
I do. Everybody says that. I am a mathematician at heart, but it does help because I find that math gives you this ability to take something in one area and kind of get to the core of like how it's working. And what is the core of this thing, and then bring it over into a completely unrelated field, something that's completely different that you would think that has nothing to do with this, and then reattach that core and give it a new life in a new field. And I think that's a lot of what human factors is about, because as you were saying, you have all these different disciplines, and that is not uncommon for our field. Everyone has like interests in all of these different areas. We're the ones who bring it together. We're kind of the glue that attaches the human, you would say, to all of our machines and our necessary interactions through life. What about you, Deanne?
Absolutely. And I am the liberal arts major in the room, although I also have the psychology background, again, creating connections between. I would say that I was just talking to someone about this today. I had actually been on track to get my doctorate in English and be a professor, and I was at Oxford, you know, at the pinnacle of my academic growth as an individual at that time. And we were bickering one day over isms. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I heard outside the window, "Oxford tours leaving in 10 minutes." And I thought to myself, the world outside does not care
about isms.
About isms, about what we're doing, and no one will read what we're publishing in those dusty journals. We're publishing in it to keep our jobs or to publish for one another so we can bicker about isms more. And so what I've gleaned out of my time in English is that I am very interested in going deep and understanding the experience and removing from that what is the essential need-to-know aspects of it, and then applying that analysis to actual design. But I also come from a slightly different perspective on that question, in that I kind of believe in a sort of serendipity in my job life, in that every project I have had has, even though I think at the time, this job is a dead end or this project is silly, it's been a learning experience, and I can apply things from jobs that I never thought I could or would. So I think you hit it on the head there earlier that it is the culmination, everything we do, every experience we can apply to this. So.
And actually, I can add to that in a second if you I was just going to say, interesting story about also how that serendipitous kind of thing kind of follows through. When I was hunting around for human factors jobs over at USF, I was running around from lab to lab to lab. And one lab, terrible experience, which of course led me to another lab. While I was at that second lab, I learned a lot about multimedia and video editing and using that for scientific analysis, behavioral analysis, and that was a useful experience. And then that one skill that I learned in that next lab is actually what got me into that robotics lab, because basically that robotics lab learned about that behavioral analysis approach, and because I knew how to put that setup together and run it efficiently, I got a job, and that's what led me into robotics, and then from that first publication, and here I am again. So serendipity really does come into things quite a bit sometimes.
And here's another one, though. It's also if you run into evil situations. And John, yeah, I might have told both of you about this already. I don't know. But working at certain jobs with certain difficult circumstances on certain difficult products, I have learned sometimes, even more importantly, how to avoid those negative situations and or to manage it differently in the future, and that has been a real joy. That's probably common in most situations, but there's something special about our profession in which it puts us in between different warring factions, and we're also the relatively new kid on the scene, and yeah. So we also have to negotiate and define who we are, our roles and responsibilities to others.
We're that bridge of communication between these groups which don't understand each other.
Mm-hmm. At all.
So you have marketing, and you have engineering, and you have the engineering guys who, yeah. It's, and we're that glue, as I was saying, and we're that bridge of communication, so we can take mm-hmm. something in marketing speak and then translate it into engineer.
So translate it to engineer, I like that. I speak engineer.
Yes.
I speak psychology. I speak people.
Well said. So let's do the elevator pitch exercise. So if you're explaining this to another human who's not necessarily an academic, what might you say?
This seems to be the biggest problem we have, too. It's like, how do we succinctly say what we do? But what I say is I say that I make computers and machines easier to use and less frustrating to use. Okay. And I leave it at that. I just like to leave it as simple. And then if they have specific questions, then I'll go into something on doors. I'll give them a full example if they express more interest. So I'll say, okay, you see that door over there? Here's why the next five people are going to like try and push on it when they should be pulling. And I'll show them. And it's kind of like this light goes on. You can see it through the eyes. You can see this light go on in their brain of, like, this whole new world that they never saw of, oh, yeah, it's something I've experienced my whole life. Now I see why.
Mm-hmm. And you, Thomas?
Whenever people ask me this, and I do get a lot of people asking me about it, I always say that human factors, it basically looks at how people use tools and technology. The tool can be as simple as the pen that you're working with, the chair that you're sitting in, or it can even be as complex as going to computers, agents, and robotics. And what I do, my area within this big, vast thing is robotics and how people work with it and what makes it natural. So.
And actually, could you expand on what you want to do with robotics?
What I want to do with robotics.
What don't you want to do? Look at that.
There are a lot of things that I guess if I were going to bring it down into a nutshell, my goal with robotics is to really increase. Well, how do you put something like this so succinctly? Basically, I want to make it easy for a person to interact with a robot and use that robot as a tool in a certain circumstance or in other circumstances where there may be some sort of intelligent autonomy behind the system. How do you treat that robot as a teammate? And to make that interaction and use as natural as possible. That would be my ultimate goal, whether that's working in teams, whether that's one person with one robot, one person with multiple robots. A lot of the questions still haven't really been dealt with yet. So, and there's still a lot of room for development in the technology in itself, and that's one of the reasons why I say both people have their jobs to do all at the same time. And even while each person can develop and kind of just move in their own little direction, it's really important to keep that glue together in the crosstalk so that they can actually develop towards a common goal. And that's the real challenge is to really pull people together so the goal is shared. The shared goal also moves in a good direction. And actually always questioning what you're doing and questioning whether you're moving in the right direction. So
what do you guys feel is the most frustrating part of working in human factors?
Oh, dear.
You go first.
Okay. I'm now going to invoke the Prince of Darkness. that's a a pseudonym for a person I once worked for rather recently. The politics. Okay. The politics of design, the power struggle of it all. Because I sincerely want to see the product succeed. And succeeding has to do with critical goals being met of the marketing folks, essentially, and engineering folks want it turned out on time, they want it functional, they want to look good. And, of course, the user wants to have this positive experience. And as I said, I see myself as the translator between these parties. I have this true need to do the right thing. And so if I am blunted in my my ability to help, I find that the most frustrating thing. Or to have someone cut out from under me and say, no, it's got to be this way for various reasons, and not even for practical ones, I wonder to myself, well, what am I doing here? And if I can't truly contribute, then I do feel a need. Maybe it's time to move on, and they need to find that point of need in their business model before I can truly come in and help. And so it's like I was talking with Alan Hedge this morning, and it's sort of like perhaps in some instances, even though you were hired to do a specific job, perhaps sometimes it's better to just sit back and wait until they say, what do you think? Until they really truly are ready to hear what you have to say. So that's actually a lesson learned thing for me there, but certainly it's that compression on the role. That's my little spiel.
Okay. We all have many frustrating experiences, I think, and while I could break it down into specifics, I'd say generally when you get to such a high level of academic achievement, you've specialized in a certain area, you're obviously very accomplished. But by the same token, many times people are very accomplished in one special area, and that accomplishment in that one area may not necessarily generalize to another area and vice versa. So basically my biggest frustration is, especially since this is such an interdisciplinary field and there is such an, I interpret that to mean that there is a need for teamwork, and one person cannot do it all on their own. And people that have specialized in their certain areas need to recognize that their expertise does have limitations. I have limitations. You have limitations. Everyone has limitations. You need to recognize your limitations and learn when to ask for help. And I believe that that's really my most frustrating thing is when people don't recognize this. And ultimately, my solution to that is teamwork. But yes,
I think that's very, very well said. And you, John?
Well, for me, it's that I can no longer go to Best Buy in peace. Like, anytime I go to any sort of like electronic store or download a new program on the computer, I'm excited. They've got marketing. I'm excited. I really want it to be great. And it's like I know so much about it's like if they just put this button here, it would work so much better with the user's mental model. And it's like I know too much. Like I see behind the curtain. And it's so every piece of like technology frustrates me now. And it's
that is true.
Yeah.
We are seen as the complainers.
Yeah. It's kind of a Cassandra complex thing. You feel you know exactly what to do with this. I can
no
sit
one's
there
ever going to live
and
up
no
to that.
One listens like unless they you can do something for one company at a time, but then you go into a store with all these other products and all of them need something. And that would be the most frustrating thing for me.
Well, that does get into an interesting point though. I mean, Even with human factors, we're always talking about, oh, there's this perfect ideal, and that's really what we're going for. But then there's also the realistic expectation or there's the real world. What can you really get done versus what's perfect? Mm-hmm. And I'd have to say, even though it may not always be perfect, and that's is frustrating many times, even the smallest attention to the user is better than no attention to the user. So for me, I'm just happy if anyone even starts to look at it. And that's one thing that I also have to tell myself at the same time. Even if I look at a, it can be an academic work or it can be something else, and I look at that and say, my God, that's terrible. I mean, at the same time, I have to tell myself that in some other place, this may actually have some use at the same time. And learning self-restraint is a very challenging task, but it also at the same time, if you learn to restrain yourself in certain circumstances, you can also learn from that and how it might be helpful for someone else and try to see the silver lining. But at the same time, it's very frustrating. So.
And actually, to that end, like Microsoft Natural Keyboard, I may be misspeaking that, but he intentionally withheld his design for a full year before revealing it to the higher-ups because he knew they could not be receptive, and if he sprung it too soon, it wouldn't go anywhere. It'd be summarily trashed. So that is another sort of moral, ethical thing that we face because, again, as John pointed out, you know, we know the way, the truth.
Mm-hmm. But, and the
light. Yes, but being able to share it all at once, you can't necessarily do.
Right.
Exactly. So how do you manage that trade-off of the perfect, you know, you've got the perfect interface and then you've got all these time constraints of what can mm-hmm. be done. You've got all these different constraints brought in by different people. How do you navigate that?
I would say that goes to negotiation to some degree, and we have to weigh the pros and cons of, because ultimately it has to roll out and hit the market. Ultimately, it will have a due date. So sometimes it's cost, sometimes it's technology, sometimes it's also noticeability. We've also employed the 80%, which still hurts, the 80% rule being, you know, what percentage of the world is really affected by this. Myself, and this is going to be revealing a personal factoid, but I'm always thinking of better designs. I have soap crayons in my bathroom because I often think of ideas and I'll start drafting in the shower or on the bathroom mirror and I'm like, oh, I've got the toothbrush in my mouth. And I'm like, that's the perfect search interface. That's it. So I'm continually striving for the best, and it's just a matter of time before we're able to truly roll out an interface that does it right or does it pretty close to perfect.
In the same way, I have a legal pad, which I carry around with me, of craft paper.
So that's what you're carrying.
That's what I'm carrying all the time. I just have different ideas that I come up with, and mm-hmm. I used to take it to restaurants. I don't do that as much anymore. I've had several girlfriends who have weaned me of that habit, but... I don't think I'll say more.
How do I deal with it? Well, I won't talk about it in terms of the perfect interface or the perfect this or the but I will say in terms of, say, projects. Because I do a lot of work with research projects. And with us, instead of producing an interface, we're producing research. So study design. And with, say, our recent project, it was finding a way to manage about 15 different people working on one project and getting things done. So a lot of what you said, a lot of it comes down to weighing pros and cons and what's the real question that I'm getting at? What do I need to get this done? While this technology may not be perfect, is it enough to get the job done? And many times you do have to ask that, and while you can't always get the perfect thing out there, it is something that gets you closer to what it is you need to study.
One of the things I find interesting, one of the first things we learn in user testing is you listen to the users and their ideas, and then you disregard what they're actually saying, and you look behind it for the meaning, and you're saying, what are you really trying to do?
Yes.
Not what do you want, mm-hmm. but what are you really trying to do? And I mm-hmm. try to deal with managers and other groups in the same way. I take what they're asking me. They're saying, here's a particular design, and I say, okay, good. Now, what are you trying to accomplish with that? What is? And then I try, this doesn't always work, but I try to come up and incorporate it into a design and say, okay, but here's another way to do that that is better for you and it's easier for you. Mm-hmm. And when you can do that, it helps to speed things up.
And looking at the three of us as relatively new professionals to the field, I would like to, you know, in our remaining time, I don't know how long this will go, but what do you want to leave behind, or where do you see it going?
Where do I see it going?
And you personally, what,
me,
so where's it going?
Where do I see the field going, or
and where do you fit into? What
where
is
do
your
I
contribution?
Fit into it? Well, I'm just going to talk about my general area in particular. There's a lot to be done with robotics still. Whether we like it or not, the technology is coming. It can be useful. And no, it will not replace people. It'll just change what they do in relation to the technology. I guess my job in that would probably be to guide that as best as I possibly can, and to help move things forward, to go for the best interaction, go for the best use, increase usability as much as possible.
I would say that my big belief about usability is that if we provide the tools that make it so that the laziest path for the programmer gives the right interaction, then that will bubble up. So if we can get down to the lowest level, and this is an area everybody looks at me and they're like, don't go there, it's a scary place.
Don't go there,
but
go.
I started in programming, and I want to get down to the lowest level, and I want to make that and keep usability as an idea in there, down to the APIs, down below that, and just get it so that when the programmer goes to make something, all the tools which they use to build your program have already been checked for usability. They already have that designed in. So if they're lazy, as long as they don't go out of their way, they're going to have something that is at least somewhat usable, and as opposed to today's default, which is like standing in the line at the DMV. So that is, I hope that is my legacy, I hope, is to have programmer tools be usable.
Okay, so side note on this. I've known you for a while, John, and I haven't heard you crystallize. Now I understand your thesis.
Yes.
Brilliant.
Yes.
Go forth and prosper.
It's a very unpopular idea.
No, I think it's tremendous. I understand its value. I'm going to be, you know, cheering you on. Wow. Well, I would say that technology, like it or not, has become increasingly integrated into our lives. And I was clutching a typewriter going, no, 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 I don't want to go to a computer. Again, it's interesting I'm in this job. So I would say I have varied interests. I'm very interested in driving and mobile apps. And I see mobile apps as really the point where technology is truly there at the point of need. But perhaps if we could eliminate user manuals, we have done a great service to mankind. Where do I fit in? I also want to be training the next generation of professionals. I think it's going to be increasingly important that others know how to do this, do it well, because it extends into areas beyond technology. So that would be my contribution. So 2 minutes. So, John?
Shall we sing a duet?
No, you've been coming up with good questions. I have one. I would say, what would be something funny that you've gotten out of the profession that you can share in brief?
You come back to me for that. I have to think.
Okay, something funny that's happened. How about something challenging?
Challenging integration. I mean, it's always going to be integration and... Because, again, we work with so many different areas. I think teamwork is important, and the real difficulty there is integrating people that are so very, 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 very different. So.
Okay. And actually, on a similar note, I would say my greatest professional challenge has been creating an interface for children, a testing interface for children with disabilities.
Oh, yeah.
And also the setup and whatnot, and you have such a broad range.
Yeah.
But, my goodness, at the end of the day, we had dyslexia, we had blindness, we had motor motor issues, we really did something good.
Yeah, and actually I'm going to say something else. One thing that I noticed when I did work with the Office of Disabilities, like I said, I'm all over the place sometimes, but there isn't always a lot of money to go into developing things for disabled populations or unique populations because there is no money and it is such a small group of users. So anyway, that is an interesting challenge.
I'm still trying to think of something funny.
I
just live my life as like things that are funny, and now they're like, "What's a funny thing?" and they just all go out of my head.
Well, I'm thinking of the remote. Can you talk about that?
No, I cannot.
Never mind. It never happened.
It did not happen.
Well, I have a funny one that I can share on behalf of someone else. We're out of time.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. Next episode.
Thomas signing off.